It's really helpful for me, and I hope it is for you, to know that fear, just like all the other emotions, is a completely common experience for all of us. All sentient beings, actually. Isn't that cool? Like, if you see a spider crawling and you try to squash it, what does it do? It runs away, right? We all have fear. In fact, most of us feel big and little fears many times a day, don't we? Sometimes we might feel like it's somehow always there, like it's just somehow in the air we're breathing. We might even wake up with it. We might feel that. Do any of you remember just one small fear today? Show of hands. How many of you had many fears today? I mean, I'm going to raise my hand, I guess. So look around you. Well, I guess everybody put their hand down, but from up here, I saw a lot of hands. And yet, it's so interesting, even though all of us feel and experience fear so much on so many levels, just little levels, whenever we notice that we're feeling afraid, one of the first things we do is to somehow criticize or judge ourselves for having fear in the first place. Isn't that true? One of our first instincts, actually, is to want to hide it from others. Maybe that's why I didn't see a lot of hands. I don't have any fear, right? Not me. And we hide it even from ourselves, you know? It's so interesting. When we do that, for instance, we might try to prop ourselves up with ideas about courage. Like, we can pretend that we aren't feeling fear. I'm not feeling fear. And it reminds me of the Cowardly Lion from The Wizard of Oz. He says, I like to think of this. When he first saw Dorothy and Tin Man along Yellow Brick Road, this is what he said. He said, put them up, put them up. Which one are you first? I'll fight you both together if you want. I'll fight you with one paw tied behind my back. I'll fight you standing on one foot. I'll fight you with my eyes closed. So I can't do him, but, you know, you see him. And what happened? What popped his bubble? Toto, right? This little bitty dog scared the crap out of him. So the interesting part of that, I love that character. He's so lovable because I know for me, I can, you know, if I'm honest, I can see a part of me in him. I think we can all see parts of ourselves in him. We're just like, you know, pretending we're not scared. So I find it incredibly helpful to remember that fear is universal, totally natural, and it's going to continue to arise. You know, it's always going to be there, actually. That's the bad news. The good news is that we can learn to relate to fear differently. And this includes accepting that it's going to arise and having great kindness for ourselves whenever it does. So many years ago, I was beating myself up for feeling fear about something. I can't remember what it was. And I came across this quote from Pema Chodron that really struck me. And it made me just feel so relieved. She wrote, "It is not a terrible thing that we feel fear when faced with the unknown." Just that sentence. It's a whole paragraph, but isn't that great? It's not a terrible thing that we feel fear when faced with the unknown. It is a part of being alive, something we all share. We react against the possibility of loneliness, of death, of not having anything to hold on to. Fear is a natural reaction to moving closer to the truth. That last line, I think, is really important. Fear is a natural reaction to moving closer to the truth. So after 25 years or so of practice, whenever I feel fear, I actually kind of get a little excited now. I bow to it. I say, oh, fear's here. Because I know that if I can face it, it's like, here's a challenge that's going to help you to grow. And I bow to that instead of running. You know, we learn to lean into it, and that's where our power and our freedom and our growth happens. So it might be helpful to know that throughout his life, the Buddha, the enlightened one, faced fear. That made me feel so much better. The Buddha had fear throughout his life. So many of you likely know this classic story. So on the night of before his enlightenment, the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree for 49 days, and he fought a great battle with the demon Mara, who attacked the then Bodhisattva Siddhartha with everything he had. Okay, so Mara's a metaphor for the lust, greed, anger, fear, you know, all our neuroses. So Mara sent him things in visions, like 3D projections, like armies of monsters and boiling mud, blistering sand, ridiculously loud, scary noises, and hordes of seductive women. It's kind of like some of the summer movies that are out there right now, right? All this stuff. According to the story, Siddhartha remained undisturbed by these distractions. The visions turned into flowers, Mara dissolved, and he became enlightened. Okay. What I love to remember about this story is that even after the Buddha became deeply revered in India, Mara continued to make frequent appearances. And his loyal attendant, Ananda, was always on the lookout for Mara or for any harm that might come to his teacher. And, you know, he would come up to the Buddha and say, "The evil one has returned again." And instead of ignoring Mara or driving him away, the Buddha would actually calmly say, "I see you, Mara. I see you. You know, I see you." Ananda would kind of get freaked out, like, "He's here again." And the Buddha would just say, "I see you." And the great thing that the Buddha did was he invited Mara in for tea. Many of you know the story, as an honored guest. So he would say, "Come on in," and he'd give him a cushion, and he'd put cups of tea in between them, and they would sit for a while. And then finally Mara would go. And throughout, the Buddha remained undisturbed. The name Mara in Pali actually means delusion or illusion. And I like to think of our fears as just this. They're ghosts, aren't they? They're just ghosts that are haunting us. They're not real. I looked up some definitions of the word ghost and came up with these. A vague, shadowy, or effervescent form wandering among or haunting living persons. A mere shadow or semblance. A trace. A remote possibility. So while our fears can really appear real, we need to remind ourselves that many of our recurring fears aren't real. They're not real. It's like what Tara Brach often calls real but not true. You know, it feels real, but there's not true. A ghost produces a feeling of fear in the body, but the belief or the illusion that's frightening us needs to be questioned. Another way to think about it, again, is like when you're watching a movie. And when you're watching a movie and you're really into it and you're buying the storyline, you're completely in, you know, you forget that you're eating popcorn or there's other things going on, you're totally in. You can get that same feeling, right? And then you kind of step back and say, it's just on the screen, it's just a movie. The characters aren't real. It's also helpful to remember that fear is never about what's right here, right now in this moment, is it? It's never about what's right here. It's always about what's going to come. So even if, like, a bear, one of my teachers, I can't remember which one, was talking about this, like if a bear has bitten you, what's right here is the pain of the, you know, you have been bitten. The fear is about the bear's going to bite you again, right? Even though it hasn't. It's always about what's next. In the Buddhist teachings, there are two kinds of fear. One is healthy fear, and one is unhealthy. So we actually need fear. Sometimes fear is really healthy. It's important to know this. Like, for instance, when we're walking down a dark alley at 2 in the morning, you know, in Washington, D.C., probably not wise. You know, you have to be discerning. We need a healthy fear of traffic, hot things, watching our children. So we all have intuition, and we really need to honor that. It's not like we need to get rid of all fear. It's here for a reason. But what happens is that it can move from healthy fear into unhealthy fear. And how you recognize this is that it's moved into kind of obsessive panic, right? So your mind is grabbed onto something, and it's just spinning out of control. It's running with it. Pema Chodron often talks about this as the hook. You're just completely hooked. And it keeps getting bigger and bigger, and you're spinning out horrific narratives about things. Maybe, if, for instance, if you have children, you might see them running out into traffic. Keep seeing that over and over. Or being kidnapped. Or maybe not getting into Yale, whatever your particular thing is. it's really helpful also to know that our fear, most of our unhealthy fear, comes from our history, what are called all our causes and conditions. So all the things that have happened in our lives, all the experiences we've had, our upbringing, our culture, all of it has combined into these causes and conditions. And so Tara often says we're not to blame for our causes and conditions. And I really get that now. It's like they're in there. The causes and conditions are in there. We can't really do anything about our history, but we can learn to relate to them differently. That's the beauty of it. But we're not to blame. The example I like to use for this is like if a little girl was bitten by a dog when she was little, which happened to my niece, actually, little Cocker Spaniel chewed off like part of her face, like munched on it. So she's terrified now as an adult of any dogs, even a puppy. She'll say, get it away, you know, get away from me, get away from me. It's a, you know, a dog. So nobody in here would blame her for that, right? That was her experience. That was her causes and conditions. And do you see that it's not true? Not all dogs are evil and are going to bite her, but that's her belief. And so many of our fears are that. They come from our own particular causes and conditions. So it's really helpful to know in yourself what those causes and conditions are and not to blame yourself when you feel fear, which makes it worse. For instance, if someone was in some way cruel to you or said something to hurt you in some way, you might now be afraid of experiencing that same hurt again or even create stories in your mind about the truth of this, just like that little girl might create a story about the puppy is going to bite her. It's a story. So again, it's really helpful to remember that we all do this, so there's no need to blame yourself or beat yourself up. And I'm going to offer you tonight just some ways to work with fear through your meditation practice. So there's many different ways to do this. So the first one is, and it sounds very counterintuitive, which most of Buddhist practice is, but the path out is always through. The path out is through. So the Buddha actually encouraged us to allow ourselves to feel the fear instead of running away, covering it over, freezing, I don't know what to do now, which are some of our typical reactions to fear. The practice actually urges us to open up, turn around, like if we're running from a monster, stop, turn around and face the monster, face the fear, open up tomorrow. Feel and sense the sensations in the body. Get really curious. What does fear feel like in the body? What is that experience? We want to run away from it or cover it over or hide it. You know, the practice is, okay, fear's here. Let me check it out with great kindness and curiosity, okay? And we need to investigate our thoughts, the beliefs that are creating the fear in the first place. Sometimes all we need to do to begin is just have the intention to dip our toe in. So, you know, especially for traumatic fear, if there's like a big traumatic fear, you don't want to like go running and jump and plunge into the water, you know, if you're afraid of, you know, can't swim. You don't want to go dive into the water. What you want to do is you want to dip your toe in. Okay, this is so bad. Okay, it's now it's getting worse. Bring it back out. Okay, I'm going to put my whole foot in now. That's not too bad. Okay, I'm going to, and by doing this, you start to get familiar with it until you can finally put your whole body in. Okay, does that make sense? One of my teachers, Pat Coffey from Charlottesville. Anybody know Pat? Yeah? Okay. He talked about it this way. I love it. It's like seeing a huge tiger on the edge of the woods, right? It's like your biggest fear. You see it. And the first thing you do is just like the Buddha saying, I see you tomorrow. You just say, I see you. I see you, right? And then you might take a few steps towards the forest. And then you might take a couple more. And the process might take minutes, might take days, it might take years. This might be a process of years. It doesn't matter. It's your intention. I'm going to take a step. Oh, nope, not ready yet. I'm going to take another step. It's your intention. You plant that intention. And interestingly, by the time you get up to the edge of the woods, you might realize that tiger is a kitten, right? or it's a shadow. It kind of looked like a kid. I thought it was a tiger, but I guess it's just a shadow. So our tendencies, besides running away, covering over, freezing, what we also tend to do is exaggerate the fear. You know, pampancha, we proliferate the fear. We make it bigger and bigger. So instead of a tiger, for instance, you might imagine that it's now a whole herd of demon tigers, you know, coming after you. We also try to change it into some other emotion, anger, sadness, shame, you know. We might puff ourselves up, I'm not afraid, we do that. And I think one of the biggest things that I've mentioned that we do is we tend to judge ourselves. For instance, whenever you feel fear, you might notice thoughts like, I shouldn't be feeling this way, or what's wrong with me? Why am I so afraid? Anybody have that? I shouldn't be? Why am I so afraid of this? Whenever you feel, hear the word should in the mind, when you catch it, know that it's toxic. Investigate your shoulds. You know, sometimes it's don't should all over yourself, it's that thing. Mm-hmm. So again, the basic practice is become aware of your thoughts. What movie, what storyline are you buying into? What are you completely caught up in? What are the thoughts? Remember that those thoughts are conditioned and likely untrue. And with great, great kindness, bring your attention back to what's happening right now in your body. This is really important. So every time you notice that you're getting tangled in that thought and that fear thinking, make an effort to return to the body, because the body, by the way, will never lie to you. The body cannot be anywhere else but the present moment. It's right here. Our mind is so often not in the present moment, and it lies to us. It's in the past or the future, and it lies to us. The body is always right here. So if you can come back to the body, you can really come back to what's true. For most of us, anger, if you start exploring the body, anger is in the chest, lands more in the chest. Sadness is in the mid-abdomen. And fear is actually in the deepest part of the abdomen. Okay? So fear is actually the deepest feeling in the body, and it's the most basic human feeling. The sensation of stage fright, actually, is a pressure at the diaphragm. So it's a tightening as to not to feel fear. Interestingly, this tightening begins at the sphincter, so tight ass is not just an expression. It proceeds up the torso, so to speak, all the way up, and it's squeezing until it has us by the throat. And then we can't speak because we're scared. It's got us right here. So if we can catch this process, if we're more in touch with the body, we can really start to notice it when it starts and not clamp down against it, which makes it worse, right? Clamping down on the fear, but with curiosity kind of allowing it. Ah, what's this? You know, stage fright, whatever it is. So when you can notice the fear, notice where it's beginning in the body, You learn not to be afraid of it, because you start to notice that it's just a physical sensation. It's a ball of changing energy. It's not a solid thing that we have to push against. It's like, oh, that's interesting. Here's fear. The experience of fear might be really uncomfortable. It's not fun, is it? Fear? But when you're able to stay and watch the fear manifest in the body, again, it's not a solid wall of emotion. It's a constantly changing flow of energy process in the body. In her book, How Not to Be Afraid of Your Own Life, Susan Piver, teacher, notes, you can be completely afraid without being afraid that you're afraid. Isn't that great? Isn't that true? You can be completely afraid without being afraid that you're afraid. We do this by becoming curious and familiar with fear. With all the emotions, this is what we do. We become familiar, friendly with them. Fear in particular really demands to be felt. But once you've allowed it its say, it actually surprisingly does end. It has its say and then it goes. It's kind of like the Buddha when he acknowledged Mara. You know, when Mara comes to the door, the Buddha doesn't run into the other room, right? Go away, Mara. Slam the door on Mara. Or freeze, like, holy crap, Mara's at the door. I don't know what to do. That's the freeze thing. What do I do? What do I do? He faces the fear. He goes to the door, and he opens it, and he says, come on in. Come on in. Because when you're running from your fear, hiding, fighting, you know, fighting, get out of here, freezing, guess what? The banging on the door is just going to get louder and louder and louder, and it's going to become more scary. Can you imagine if someone's banging on your door and it's soft at first, and then it's really pounding, and then it's like really banging and just keeps banging? The fear is just going to get bigger and bigger if we don't open the door a little, or even maybe open the slit on the top. Maybe we can have that intention. I see you out there, you know. The reason this is important is the more we can learn to sit and be with our fear, offer our fear tea, if you will, we become more familiar with it. I see you, I know you, I know what you look like, you know, I know what you're going to say next, that kind of thing. It becomes less scary. It's still there, it's still fear, but like Susan Piper said, it's not as scary when it arrives, right? Another way that we can work with fear in our meditation practice is we question our beliefs, okay? There's a classic Buddhist story about a monk who lives in isolation in a cave. For years and years and years, he lived in isolation, and he was an artist. And he painted these beautiful murals on the wall as part of his meditation practice. So if you can imagine this highly trained monk, this highly trained artist, painting these beautiful things on the wall of his cave. What he did was he painted a tiger, a ferocious tiger, and it was so real to him. And he was alone, right? So you can imagine. It seemed so real to him that it scared him to death. He died. That's the legend. So like that monk's, our own fears are actually created, like someone painted them on the walls of our mind. Right? They were created out of old conditioning, but we keep them alive by believing in them. There's that tiger on the wall. It's just a painting, okay? Even though also our fears aren't real, we still need to honor and respect them, just like you might respect a masterpiece on the wall of a museum. Right? We bow to it because our fears always have something to teach us. They always do. So instead of running away, we bow to our fear. What do you have to teach me? Okay. Some phrases that I've learned over the years that I find helpful for questioning my beliefs. These are just phrases that I use all the time now. They pop up in my mind the more I use them is maybe so, maybe not. Really simple. I have these code phrases. Maybe so, maybe not, you know. Another one is not always so. Not always so. Because we think something's always that way, don't we, sometimes? And if you can just put that little seed of not always so, not always so in there. One of my favorites is, what if nothing's wrong? What if nothing's wrong, you know? Good one to contemplate and chew on. Can also be fun to name your most common fears. Your 8-track tapes, they're ancient. That's why they're 8-track. Anybody remember 8-track tapes in here? Yeah? They're ancient. And we all know our particular songs, don't we, when they arise? So get to know them and you can name them. Like, name them funny things. Like, you know, because it helps make them a little smaller. Like, I see you, big ol', I'm going to totally F this up fear. Whatever it is. So another way to work with fear through the practice, and we did a little bit with this through the meditation practice today, is we find a place of refuge or safety in the body. Really important. Sadly, we're actually wired through our DNA to feel more fear than safety. you know, we were, we kind of evolved that way for different reasons that I won't get into. But we need to counteract this by learning to recognize and nurture a feeling of safety in our bodies. We can do this through our practice. We can nurture that feeling of safety. Feeling our groundedness, the earth element in our bodies. We can nurture and remember our sense of connection. You know, we're not separated from the earth or one another. And we can start to nurture those places within us that feel safe. So through our practice, we actually make a conscious, mindful intention to start to notice when we have those moments of pleasure or safety or happiness, and we consciously lean into them. We let ourselves experience that just as fully as we allow ourselves to indulge in the fear. Because so often we let that stuff pass. We just let it, that the good stuff pass, and we're focused. We're highly focused on the fear. So there's some science around this, actually. Anybody read Rick Hansen's book, The Buddha's Brain? Yeah, he's great book, by the way. He's a neuroscientist and a meditation teacher, and in his book he discusses all these fabulous ways to use the practice to train the mind based on science, which I love. And one of the things that he talks about is that, calls it leaning into the good. And what this means, again, is like when, say if you're petting your pet or something, you know, that feeling of just like joy or just happiness and you feel safe, or your cat or your dog is in your arms or your child, notice it. Oh, here's a moment of joy and safety in my body. I want to nurture that. If you lean into it, and by leaning into it, he means like really expanding that feeling through the body, really nurturing it for 30 seconds. Now, that might be a long time if you looked on your watch. None of us have watches anymore. If you looked at your cell phone for 30 seconds, it seems like a long time, right? But it's not really. And what happens when you start doing that more and more often is that neurons that wire together fire together. You're going to have that feeling in your body more often. You're training your body to feel more safe than fearful. It's kind of awesome. Just try it, okay? Just try it this week as an assignment. Interestingly, there's also science around putting a slight smile on the lips and the eyes. I do this sometimes during the day when I'm feeling like stressed out. Try it right now. Just, there's a chemical reaction in the body that stops the fight, flight, freeze impulse. And you see the Buddha doing that, right? When he's meditating, he's got that little slight smile. So you can do, it doesn't have to be exaggerated, you know, when you're meditating, but you can just put a little slight smile on the face. It helps. So again, going back to the days of the Buddha's enlightenment, there's a story that shows us how the Buddha tapped into his body in this way. I love this story. So at the end of his 49 days under the Bodhi tree, Mara gave the Buddha his final challenge. Anybody know what that was? It was doubt. Right? That was his final challenge, was doubt. So with all his massive armies at his sides, Mara claimed the seat of enlightenment for himself, saying his spiritual accomplishments were better, they were greater than Siddhartha's. So it's kind of like, I like to think of like that bully in high school who's standing with all his like, with his clique saying, who do you think you are? Right? It's that person. That was Mara for the Buddha. And all Mara's monstrous soldiers cried out, I am his witness. And Mara said, who is your witness? You know, here's the Buddha. He's been sitting under the Bodhi tree for 49 days. There's nobody around. So what did the Buddha do? He reached down and he touched the earth. That you see that those statues of the Buddha, sometimes his hand is touching the earth. And the earth said, I am his witness, and rumbled and shook. And this terrified Mara and his armies. Mara was like, I give up, right? And they dispersed. And the Buddha became enlightened. So I love that he went to the earth. He was claiming his innate connection to the earth and dissolving the final remains of what Tara often calls the trance of separation. So the Buddha, the earth confirmed the Buddha's enlightenment. It was confirming itself, and the Buddha was confirming himself as part of the earth. We are part of the earth. We are all connected. We all belong, just innately. And so you can get in touch with your body, you can get the groundedness, the connection with the earth. Call on the earth to claim your own innate belonging. I do that sometimes. I claim my seat when I sit in meditation practice, and I urge you all to do that. Claim your seat, knowing that the earth is holding you. You know, it helps with that sense of separateness, which I think is our deepest suffering, isn't it? We feel separate in some way. So building on that sense of separation, the Buddha taught that the main antidote to fear is loving kindness. In fact, one of his first teachings on metta practice, loving kindness, was as an antidote to fear. So the legend goes that the Buddha sent a group of monks off to meditate in this forest that was inhabited by tree spirits, okay? And these tree spirits were really PO'd that these monks had come into their forest. Like, what? You know, what? This is our home. What are you doing here? Why are you here? And so they tried to drive the monks away by appearing as ghosts, ghoulish visions, right? Really scary noises, shrieking noises, and terrible, awful smells, like tree farts or something, right? They were being really mean to the monks. So the tradition says the monks became totally terrified, and they ran back to the Buddha, and they're like, do not make us go back into that forest. You know, the tree spirits hate us. We're not going back. Can we go to another forest, you know? And the Buddha said, no. He said, I'm going to send you back in there, but I'm going to give you the only protection you're going to need. And so the monks were imagining, you know, saws, fire, maybe a herd of beavers or something, right? And instead, the Buddha said, I want you to go back in there and I want you to recite the metta phrases. But he didn't say go back in there, like use them as an incantation or just say the words. He said, I want you to go back there and I want you to practice loving kindness. Really nurture loving kindness for these tree spirits. And that's what the monks did. They went, okay. And they faced their fear and they went back in there and they practiced loving kindness. And after a while, the tree spirits became so moved by the beauty and loving energy of these monks that they resolved to care and serve for the monks in all ways. So again, I think this really points to what unites us all as human beings and even all the plants and animals, like those trees, is a yearning for union, for overcoming our feelings of separateness. You might notice that whenever you're feeling fear, you're also feeling separate, aren't you? Just take a moment just to check that out. When you're feeling fear, don't you feel some kind of separation? Our biggest fear is probably that somehow we're not enough, that we are somehow unworthy or unloved, so therefore we don't belong to the whole. It's really helpful to remember that fear is conditioned too, and it's not true. It's not true that you're unworthy or that you don't belong. We all innately belong, and we're all innately worthy. We all have that beautiful Buddha nature within us. It's like, I like to think of it as like we're the sun, and all our beliefs and conditioning are just like the clouds in front of the sun, but we believe the clouds. We don't see that, so we start to see little specks of the sun coming out, and then we can nurture that more and more until we believe, yeah, I am the, you know, I am the sun. I have that goodness. We all have that goodness. I'm going to quote Tara on this because I love this quote. She says, perhaps the biggest tragedy of our lives is that freedom is possible, yet we can pass our years trapped in the same old patterns. We may want to love other people without holding back, to feel authentic, to breathe in the beauty around us, to dance and sing. Yet each day we listen to inner voices that keep our life small. We listen to inner voices that keep our life small. So I want to just, I don't know, plunk this seed into your mind that those voices that tell you that you're small, those are the ones to question. Those are the ones that are conditioned and absolutely not true. And those are the hardest ones to let go of. But I want to just plant that seed of intention in the mind. Teacher Jack Kornfeld writes of practice as a marriage of love and awareness, loving awareness. And I like to personally think of it as the two C's, which is compassion and curiosity, the two C's. In the Tibetan tradition, it's called bodhicitta, awakened heart-mind. Bodhi means awake, citta is heart, and they're the same. Mind-heart are not different, bodhicitta. So whenever we're feeling that fear, especially that fear of I'm not worthy, especially that one, we can intentionally meet it and hold it with the marriage of love and awareness, curiosity, compassion, loving awareness. So just to end, I'm going to give you a personal example of how I use all these steps in my own life, an example in my own life. So when I was younger, my father used to give me, he was kind of cruel, sadly, and he used to give me the silent treatment. Has anybody ever gotten the silent treatment? Just curious. See some heads nodding. It's really hard. And so I know I have that in my conditioning. By the way, your conditioning is going to continue to arise. It's in there, but you can meet it differently. So that's my conditioning. So what happens is if I write somebody an email and I ask a specific question, for instance, and they don't get back to me for like 2 days, my conditioning comes up. I see it. It's so interesting. It's like I watch my mind say, oh, they're mad at me, or I did something wrong, or I'm not important. I'm not important enough for them to email me back, or something. All this stuff gets made up in my mind. And my identity, we hook our identity on these things, on these beliefs. So my identity in that moment becomes someone who's not worthy of respect. So it's interesting, though. It doesn't bother me anymore because I know how to, I have the tools to work with this, you know? So the first thing I do is I see it and I catch it and I name it. There you are, silent treatment fear. Ah, there you are, you know? I'm familiar with it. I know it really well. Then I sense the feelings of fear and not worthy in my body. There's a sense of fear, especially, like I said, in the tummy. I can feel it in my tummy. And I instantly bring compassion to myself for my causes and conditions. My father gave me the silent treatment. Of course I'm going to have that conditioning. It's okay. It's like, oh, it's okay, honey. It's okay. I instantly bring compassion. Then I question my beliefs. Maybe so, maybe not. Not always so. What if nothing's wrong? And I have to tell you that 99.9%, nothing, absolutely nothing's wrong. It's all in here. I remember to find and nurture those places of safety in the body. I might put a hand on my tummy and on my heart. I feel the groundedness in my seat and my feet. Okay, really feel the groundedness. I sense my belonging. I reclaim my belonging. I belong to the earth, you know. The truth of non-separation, that seed of not worthy is not true. I question that. Sometimes it's really helpful, too, to remember, for me to remember all those people who also feel the same fear, that I'm not alone. I saw so many heads in here nodding about the silent treatment. You are not alone. You're not alone in your fears. Sometimes that's, you know, again, that sense of separateness. I'm the only one that has this fear. It's not true. So coming back around to the truth of impermanence again, it also really helps me remember that everything's transitory, including fear, which is just a rising and passing emotion. Part of my story is that I started out 25 years ago at Naropa University, which is founded by a Buddhist teacher, Tibetan master Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, in the Shambhala tradition. So I started out at Shambhala. So I was really into Pema Chodron. Pema Chodron is one of the students of Chogyam Rinpoche. And she recalled talking to him at one time when she had moved and changed jobs at the same time. And she came to her teacher and she said, how do I make my fear go away? I'm in total fear. And he said to her, "We are always in transition. We are always in transition. If you can just relax with that, you'll have no problem." Yeah? So that's really helpful to know. You know, it's just a passing experience. It's not going to stay there forever. Finally, it's also helpful to know that while it's a lifelong practice, the Buddha practiced it. When you learn to face fear and become familiar with it, the practice builds on itself. It builds on itself so that each time you do it, it gets easier and easier and easier. And it's, again, it's not as scary. Fear might still arise and you might sense it, but it can just be there without you being afraid of the fear itself. Okay. So I think I'll end with that, and thank you for your kind attention this evening. And I'd like to invite you now just to settle for a moment, come into a meditation with me. So again, just tapping immediately into the breath, taking a nice deep breath in, deep breath out. Maybe a couple of rounds of these. Again, that sense of drinking in kindness, knowing that the air you're breathing is life-giving. So can it be in some way nurturing to you? Sensing your seat on the chair, feet on the earth, sensing your earth element in the body, sensing the connection to the earth, really sensing that in the body. You might sense all the elements of the earth in the body: air, fire, water, earth. Claiming your seat with dignity here. Maybe placing one hand on the heart and one hand on the belly. And breathing into the fingers. Feeling the sense of comforting right through the fingers. Knowing that there's some science around this as well, that you can send comfort right through your own touch. Feels the same as another person's hand. And still breathing, just listening to these words that I'll end with by Rumi, who writes, "Keep walking. Keep walking, though there's no place to get to. Don't try to see through the distances. That's not for human beings. Move within. But don't move the way fear makes you move. Walk to the well. Turn as the earth and the moon turn, circling what they love. Whatever circles comes from the center. Whatever circles comes from the center." Namaste, 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 namaste. Have a good week, everybody.